Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Is reason alone enough to help us make sense of life? Or is some kind of faith in God, in art, in other people a necessary part of the equation? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Yann Martell's bestseller, Life of Pi, took readers on a strange and curious journey of survival with a teenage boy stranded on a lifeboat in open waters with only a tiger, who was both his only companion and a real threat to his survival. Martell's new book is another story of transformative journeys told in three linked novellas about men learning to live with loss. The new book is called The High Mountains of Portugal, and Yann Martell joins us now to talk about its themes. Yann, welcome to Think.
Hello, Chris. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Am I right about this? The narrator in Life of Pi alludes to another novel he was intending to write set in Portugal. Is this that book?
It is indeed. I developed slowly as a writer, and one of the first books I tried to write in my early 20s when I was still at university was a novel set in Portugal. And at that time, I didn't have the maturity, neither as a writer or as a person, to pull off a novel. So I put it off. And then about 15, 20 years later, when I was traveling in India, I was once again trying to write this Portuguese novel, and it still wasn't coming alive. It was a slog, so I put it aside, and I ended up writing Life of Pi instead. And it's only in the last few years that I finally figured out how to write The High Mountains of Portugal. So the story, yes, has long roots, but they're quite thin roots. Really, the novel was written in the last 4 years or so.
I'm really interested in your candor about how long it took you to develop as a writer. Our culture is so obsessed with the overnight sensation, with the wunderkind. And for many people of note, there is a long sort of growth and development and seasoning process before they are ready to do their best work.
You're right. You're right. There is an obsession with youth that typifies our North American society. I think it has to do with this fear of death. We sort of turn our backs on death, and therefore we stare at youth, and we expect things to just pop out of eggs fully formed. And that's, I'm not going to generalize, but it's certainly not the case with me. Still now at age 52, having written, six books, I still consider myself sort of in the infancy of my art. I still struggle to write sentences, to figure out what word should I use, how do I punctuate this sentence, let alone how do I conceive this entire novel. I think it's a slow process. I think generally writers in their 40s are just sort of, in a sense, graduating from high school, so to speak, in terms of writing. There's few art forms that, if you think of songwriting, pop rock songs, that tends to be a youthful art form. And that, great pop singers tend to write their best stuff in their early 20s. But that's, I think that's one of the few art forms that thrives at such an early age. I think most things take time to mature.
How conscious are you as a reader when you go back and re-encounter a work that has meant a lot to you in your youth of how different your response is now? It's always a little bit hard to remember whether we responded in exactly the same way when we were younger.
No, that's very true. We do read things differently at different ages. I remember for 4 years here in Canada, I sent the former Prime Minister of Canada books. I sent him a book every 2 weeks because he's a man who doesn't read. So every 2 weeks, I tried to, as a citizen of the arts, I thought to myself, what can I do and to this man who does not read, who's not informed by the artful word? So I thought, well, I can send him great books and tell him why he should read these books. And the usual excuse of people who don't read is that they don't have time. So I sent him short books, great short books. And so that led me on a process of discovering or rediscovering books that I hadn't read in a long, long time. So, for example, one was The Old Man and the Sea, which I hadn't read since I'd read it in high school. Hmm. I mean, it's the sort of book you read in high school, and I hadn't looked at it since. And I was surprised, because we always think of Hemingway as being this extraordinarily spare writer. His language has a great sort of cadence to it, but it's very, very spare. And I actually found The Old Man and the Sea kind of chatty. I mean, at times he talks about baseball, the New York Yankees, I think it was. And I was sort of puzzled that these little intrusions of the personal, of obviously Hemingway's own interest in baseball, or so it was a chattier work. So it's true that with the passage of time, you read things differently. We, you know, as younger readers, we perhaps are more focused on the plot element, and we don't see the character depth or something like that. But I remember with The Old Man and the Sea being surprised, being struck by its austerity when I was younger, and now more by its chattiness as an older reader.
So this story, The High Mountains of Portugal, opens with Tomás, this young man who has lost the three people he loved most dearly within days of one another, his son, his girlfriend, son's mother, and his father. And his grief manifests itself in the way he moves through the world.
Yes, he decides to turn his back on the world and on God in a quite literal way, so that he starts to walk backwards. Instead of walking in the usual way, he starts to walk backwards. And that's his first way of objecting to what has happened to him. And then the rest of that section is the other way in which he finds to object to what has happened to him. He's on this quest for this object with which he hopes to give God his comeuppance.
He comes upon this ancient diary and becomes really obsessed with it, that had belonged to a priest. What is it that he finds so compelling in this account?
Well, I think one of the usual reactions to loss, at one stage anyway, is that of anger. You know, why did this happen to me? This is not fair. I'm angry. It's a very natural emotion. It's a very natural defensive emotion. To project. I mean, you're hurt and you want to get it out of you. So in a sense, you throw it at the world. You're angry at the world. So Tomás is angry, is devastated by what has happened to him. And so he finds this diary written by a priest who is stationed on this island called São Tomé, which is off the western equatorial coast of Africa, a very important place during the slave trade. Portuguese would bring their slaves from Angola and Mozambique. They would resupply themselves on São Tomé, and then they'd take the middle passage, the crossing of the Atlantic, to Brazil to offload their slaves. And so there's this priest on this island who is there to bless these slaves, even though they don't speak his language and don't practice his faith. He's there to bring them to God. And he is profoundly homesick. And as a result of this, he starts writing this diary. And at one point, at one day, off this ship come four captives. And for the first time, after months of encountering these slaves, he sees these four captives, and he finally connects to their suffering. And he's completely overwhelmed by this. And he's dying by now. He's dying of any number of diseases that Europeans would get while in Africa. But before he dies, he determines to do this sculpture that will be his last achievement. And Tomás, our curator in Lisbon, in reading this diary, this relic from the past, discovers that this is a very, very curious sculpture. It's a crucifix, but it's a very curious crucifix. And it's not very clear that it is what he thinks it is, but it seems pretty clear. So he sets out to find it. And unfortunately for him, fortunately for him, it's not in São Tomé, but it is in the very, very northeast of Portugal. And we are talking 1904, at a time when distances were more of an impediment than they are now. So part one, the first section of the novel, is this road trip between Lisbon and the northeast of the country, where Tomás is seeking this object.
That trip, you know, goes from being fairly comical to being really quite tragic over time. I honestly had never given any thought to how difficult it was to operate an automobile before everybody knew what one was, and before, you know, driving was something that had been really simplified and that we could take for granted.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting. If you look at any technology, for example, now we don't realize how telephones used to be complicated. You used to have telephone operators, and you'd have to explain what number you want, and they'd do it for you. Every piece of technology, when it's first introduced, is far more complicated than its subsequent versions, its subsequent editions. So the automobile at the beginning of the 20th century was really vastly complicated to drive. Very hard just starting it up, for example, was complicated. And I don't just mean turning the handle at the front of it, although that was, you know, a physical feat in itself. Just the various things you had to calibrate and adjust to get it going. and then even more work to keep it going. It was a feat of technology, but by today's standards, it was very much rudimentary. And so, yes, that's the first of Tomás's problems, is that his wealthy uncle, because Tomás doesn't have much time, lends him this automobile. And this is a time when people didn't have driver's license. There were no street signs. There were no lights. There was nothing. It was a complete new transportation device that went much faster than any other one, but in an environment that was not adapted to it. And this man doesn't know how to drive. And imagine us, you know, if we all remember what it was like to be teenagers when we first sat behind a steering wheel, driving this one ton of metal down a road at, you know, 50, 60 miles an hour. It's actually quite terrifying. And so Tomás is driving something that was far slower than that, but nonetheless a big lumbering piece of technology. So it's highly, highly stressful. The automobile in part one of this novel is very much a character in itself.
It's a character, and it's a character that, you know, is ostensibly there to help Tomás, but ultimately is like his greatest impediment to getting what he wants, and it becomes quickly we realize that this thing is going to cause problems for him that he may not be able to solve.
Yes, part three in this novel, despite being the one that takes place the earliest in 1904, because the other sections of the novel take place in 1938 and the 1980s, in fact, I wrote it meaning it to resemble the most our modern lives. I find that we're often, as much as we think technology serves us, I think often the relationship is reversed and we seem to serve technology. It's interesting how every piece of technology that is invented, it's always sold to us as it will give us more leisure. You know, all these robots, all these devices will work for us and you will have more leisure. And that's a farce, because the more technology we have, it's the absolute opposite. The more frenzied our lives seem to be. So the perfect example is, I remember, you know, when the washing machine was invented, it was supposed to liberate women from the drudgery of domestic chores. Well, women just got insanely busy doing other kinds of chores. Now, maybe more entertaining than just doing laundry. But every piece of technology that is brought in just means we now are busier at trying to administer that piece of technology, and we're now taken up by something else. So I find often that these things that are supposed to lead us to a greater end, we become overwhelmed by these means, these technological means to these ends, and we forget the ends and we're completely taken up by these means. And I think we're essentially overloaded by technology. I think we're overwhelmed by it. And as much as we don't think it stresses us, we lead profoundly stressful lives, very different from the lives of animals who have no technology and live in a much more simplified environment with immediate rewards and immediate stresses. We live in one in which technology, I think, just increases our stress level. And in part one, that's exactly what happens to Tomás. He is endlessly stressed by this automobile.
He becomes enslaved to it, essentially.
Absolutely, and it grinds him down. It absolutely grinds him down. And as you said, it leads to a tragedy towards the end of that section.
We're speaking this hour with author Yann Martel. His new novel is called The High Mountains of Portugal. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Yann Martell. His previous novels include Life of Pi, Beatrice and Virgil, and Self. His new book is called The High Mountains of Portugal. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Yann, before we move to other sections of the book, I really want to talk a little bit more about Father Ulysses. He experiences this kind of conversion on his journey, despite the fact that he is already a religious person. He's had really no empathy for people held in slavery until he has this experience. And what I found most interesting about him is that we really only meet him through his letters, through this secondary sort of account, in the same way that many people are introduced to important figures of their religious lives through, religious texts.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm sorry, continue. Or go ahead.
No, that's true. We only get reflections of who he was and what happened to him, this diary that he kept. And it's interesting, the relationship between Christianity and slavery is an interesting one, because from our modern point of view, we might think that immediately Christianity, or at the origin Christ, would be opposed to slavery. But that's not the case. Christ has nothing to say about slaves. Even though slavery would have existed at the time, he would have seen slaves. Christ said nothing about slavery. And for the longest time, Christianity had a very ambiguous relationship with slavery. And, depending on your point of view, you can say, well, that's typical of the church. But if you're, I think, slightly more fair-minded, you can sort of see where they're coming from, because the thinking at the time, and they weren't necessarily comfortable with the thinking at the time of slavery, because it was such an ancestral practice. Let's not forget that slavery existed for thousands of years in all civilizations. And the thinking of the Catholic Church for many centuries was that, in a sense, we are all slaves. We're all slaves to temptation. We're all slaves to sin. And so that a person was factually a slave was just a detail, a temporal detail. But the thinking was that an actual slave could, by dint of moral effort, free herself from the slavery of sin and achieve salvation, reach up to heaven, long before the slave owner, who could be sinking in sin and being, more enslaved than the actual slave. So that was their thinking, that we're all slaves. We all suffer from temptation and sin, and that one was a slave was just a little detail of no great consequence. Now, of course, eventually that thinking changed, not because of Catholicism. The great opposition to slavery from the English came from the Protestants, because, of course, they could see the tremendous suffering that was the result of slavery. And they said, this is unacceptable. Surely Christ would not find this systematic abuse of entire peoples acceptable. But earlier on, it was very ambiguous at a time when, there was a, let's also remember, for centuries, suffering was prevalent. Everyone suffered. People, women, countless women died in childbirth. People died of diseases very early on. It was very common to die in your 40s and 50s. Death was all around. Suffering was all around. So the extra suffering of slaves, was nothing outstanding. And in case of Father Ulysses, it takes these four captives for him to, at one glance, four of the captives, three die quite quickly, and it takes this one slave, this female, gazing in her eyes to him, suddenly realize, oh my God, you suffer the way I suffer, and that transforms him entirely. But you're right, all this is refracted through his writing. We don't truly know what he saw, hence the ambiguity of the end result of this curious crucifix. As you can probably understand, I'm trying to walk to not say exactly what the crucifix
Indeed.
Is, not to ruin it for people who haven't read the book.
We won't ruin it here, because the surprise is certainly worth experiencing firsthand for people who will read this novel. It did make me think a lot, Yann, about the idea that it's so clear to us what the mistaken assumptions were of previous generations, and yet so very difficult to recognize in our own time the fallacies that we hold and the things that won't seem moral or legitimate to future generations?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you want a perfect example is climate change. I think, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people will look back at the late 20th century, early 21st century, and I think they'll be gobsmacked at our behavior. They'll be saying, you know, people used to just fly all over the world for a week holiday, a two-week holiday. They'd pump all this, these gases, these greenhouse gases high up in the atmosphere just for their own pleasure, so they can holiday for a week in the sunshine. And people used to bring little kiwi fruits all the way from New Zealand to Canada, just so they can enjoy the kiwi fruit any time of the year. Can you believe the insanity of it? And they will hold us up, you know, they will feel that we are guilty of destroying many parts of the planet as a result of this. So I think you're right. We have a certain moral clarity only in hindsight. And that's, you know, it's very hard to, in our present reality, to have that kind of clarity. It just is. We live such complicated lives. Some things we're aware of, some things we're not. And the other thing, too, is things aren't decided by single individuals. They take millions of people to come together, and it takes a meeting of mind to do that. So, yes, you're right. We don't have that clarity in the present moment. It takes time to achieve, and sometimes it's too late, and other times it's not.
The next story in this book is of this elderly pathologist, Dr. Lozora, who is visited by his wife in the office late one night when he should be working on autopsies. And Maria is such a fascinating character because she seems, from our perspective, to be in some ways a rather difficult person to like, and yet he is really crazy about her and sort of enchanted by her very loquacious way of explaining the world to him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's a very talkative woman. She appears late at night at his office and she says, "I have the solution." And he wasn't aware there was a problem. And then she goes on to lecture him at great length about the solution to the problem. Now, at the end of this section, we realize what the problem is, and it's a very deep and dark problem. And her circuitous way to the solution takes up a good half of part two. And it involves the miracles of Jesus and the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie.
And, you know, you don't see very often, you don't read anymore a lot of novels that are, you know, just so much, not even dialogue, but monologue by a character. And I thought it worked really well, but I was surprised to find this in a contemporary novel. Talk about what you thought about when you decided to explore this part of the story through what Maria had to say to Dr. Lozora.
Mm. Well, you know, rules are made to be broken, yeah. And ultimately, as a writer, you write what you're drawn to write about. So I do believe in ideas, in talking about ideas, and I studied philosophy at university. I did take English literature courses, but I primarily studied philosophy. I find ideas narratively interesting. So, you know, if we go into the details, one of the things that Maria discourses on are the miracles of Jesus, and she... And I speak of the miracles of Jesus whether people are Christian or not. It's not a question of whether you have faith or not. This is just we can look at it as a literary text, let's say, and discuss it. And what she notices is that the miracles of Jesus can broadly be divided into two broad categories. The miracles that benefit the human body. So those are all the miracles of Jesus where he cures people. You know, he cures the deaf, the blind, the lepers, the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years. He resurrects Lazarus and the woman from Nain's only son. These are all miracles that directly are medical miracles. He also, multiplies loaves of bread to feed hungry people. These are all things that benefit the human body. And first of all, she makes the observation, how interesting that those are the miracles that he performs. Why would he do these kinds of miracles rather than, as the devil tempts him to, why doesn't he just fly through the air? Or why doesn't he cast mountains into the ocean, as he himself mentions at one time? Why does he just do medical ones? And she says, well, it's because those are the sorts of miracles that would most impress us. All of us will one day die. All of us will suffer as we we edge towards death. And so things that relieve of our mortality will impress us most deeply. So that explains those. But then there's one miracle that fills all to itself the other category, because it has nothing to do with benefiting the human body. And that is the miracle of Jesus walking on water. So the each of the evangelists, as is typical, say a different thing. But Jesus says, go out. And one evangelist, one gospel writer says they go to Capernaum. One goes to another place. Anyway, they all go to a different direction. But they all agree that the Lord sends them off on this boat. And as they're rowing away, the wind is against them, and they're kind of struggling. And then Jesus stays behind to pray. And then eventually, early in the morning, they see him walking on the water towards the boat. And Matthew adds this detail of Peter says, Lord, can I join you on the water? And the Lord says, yes, sure. And so Peter walks on the water towards Jesus, but then he starts to flounder and he starts to sink. And Jesus grabs him and brings him back on board. And what's interesting about that miracle is that it's completely unlike all the other ones. There is no benefit to the human body. The adverse weather that the disciples are suffering is not anything to make them sink. So they're not going to drown. And Jesus saves Peter after he's gotten on the water and is walking on it. So it's a miracle that doesn't benefit the human body. It's a very curious miracle. There was no necessity for Jesus to walk on water. And so Maria asks herself, you know, why this miracle? Why this oddity? In texts that are as spare and winnowed as the Gospels, which after all are the result of oral tales told for decades and therefore become very, very spare, very elliptical, very elusive, why have this odd miracle that stands out? And she finally concludes that it can't be taken literally. That if you take the miracle of Jesus walking on the water in a literal way, that he literally walked on water, it means nothing. It's just sort of the supernatural trick that doesn't have any great depth. But if you read it metaphorically instead, if you see water as the experience of life, and sinking in water is sinking into sin, because after all, let's also remember, at that time, nobody would know how to swim. Swimming is a modern invention. For centuries, people did not know how to swim, and to fall into water was to fall into death. So people would be terrified of deep water because it was deep, they would drown, it was dark. So if you see it metaphorically as sinking into water is sinking into sin, what happens when you're sinking into water? Well, you look up because that's where your salvation lies. That's where air is, that's where light is, that's where you might keep on living. And so Jesus, in the light of this reading, walks on water, of course, because he is salvation. He offers purity. He offers light. He offers life. And whereas humans, mere humans, will sink. Hence why Peter starts to sink, because he is only human. Therefore, he starts sinking into his sinfulness. And Jesus walks on water because he is pure. So she realizes that if you read this metaphor with the lens of metaphor, it suddenly opens up with much more meaning. And therefore, she starts saying, well, shouldn't we read the other miracles like that through the lens of metaphor? And that leads her to look for other religious texts. And therefore she comes to the author, the only author that her husband, Eusebio Lozora, reads. All he reads is Agatha Christie. And so she points out to him the remarkable similarities between the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie and the Gospels. It's funny that if you look for a modern equivalent to the Gospels, the closest you will get are murder mysteries, and especially the murder mysteries of Agatha Christie. Because if you think of it, the life of Jesus is a murder mystery, capital M, capital M. In a sense, here's an innocent man who was murdered, and there was the greatest mystery involved with that, in that murder. And there's many, many similarities between her murder mysteries and the life of Jesus. One quick example here, the role of the witness. We know of Jesus not through any historical text. In fact, there are no historical texts. For 100 years after the death of Jesus, there's only two historical references. Pliny the Elder and Tacitus wrote very brief comments, and these were long after the facts. And Josephus, a Jewish historian, wrote very briefly about Jesus, but once again, long after his death. Essentially, the only texts we have on Jesus, because there's no other historical reference, during the life of Jesus, no one wrote about him. No one. There's no pagan text on Jesus of Nazareth. All we have on the Jesus event are Paul's letters, which are once again after the fact, and even more after the fact, the four Gospels, the four canonical Gospels. There are other Gospels, of course, but they came later. They're non-canonical. They were written later, are even more distant to the event. But the closest you get to the actual events from the Gospels are at least 30 years, a lapse of at least 30 years. Jesus died roughly in the early 30s, and the first Gospels are thought to have been written down in the early 60s of the first century. So that'd be like the first time we talk about the assassination of JFK would be in 1993, 30 years after the events. So the role of the witness is key to the Jesus event. Jesus, who never wrote down anything, he wasn't illiterate. Man, he never, like Muhammad, like the Prophet Muhammad, he did not know how to write. He only survived thanks to witnesses. And if you think in murder mysteries, the witness also plays a key role. You know, there's a murder. Hercule Poirot comes onto the scene. The first thing he does, he talks to the witnesses. And if you remember, in a crime scene, witnesses always have discrepant views. They always say things that are slightly different. They never quite get it right. It's just a odd feature of us that we never, in dramatic moments, we never quite remember or see right. It's in those discrepancies that Poirot starts to see where the truth lies. Same thing with the Gospels. Each of the Gospels is slightly different. And they're not just different in ways that don't matter. They're sometimes contradictory. It's the nature of the story. Also, curiously, it's one of these features of Agatha Christie. You read an Agatha Christie novel, and they're a compulsive read. They're so entertaining. You so want to know who did it, why did they do it, how did they do it. She's devilishly clever in the writing of her books. And there's a curious phenomenon. You read an Agatha Christie, you get to who did it, you're amazed at the ingenuity of the plot, you put the book aside, and 2 weeks later, you cannot remember who did it. You remember who the victim is. You know, she can call one of her books The Murder of Roger Ackroyd or Lord Edgware Dies. She can reveal who the victim is, and that's not a problem. But curiously, we cannot remember the victimizer, the murderer. Same thing with the Gospels. We all know who the victim was. The victim changed the course of Western history. If we came to someone on the street and quickly said to them, who killed Jesus, most people wouldn't know what to answer. They know the victim, they don't know the victimizer. Once again, there's an echo. So the two resemble each other very well, and Maria Lozora points this out to her husband to bring him greater comfort, so that when he's reading Agatha Christie, he's still hearing the voice of the Lord. There's a purpose for this, of course.
My guest is author Yann Martell. We're talking about his new novel, The High Mountains of Portugal. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Yann Martell. His new novel is called The High Mountains of Portugal. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Yann, it might surprise people to know that you yourself are not religious in any traditional way.
No, that's right. I'm, first of all, Canadian. Canada's a much more secular society than the United States, and I come from Quebec, which in the early 60s underwent something that came to be called the Quiet Revolution, which was a time when literally Quebec, which at the time was a very Catholic society, turned its back on the Catholic Church. People left the church in droves. It went from being the most Catholic society to the most progressive, social, democratic, secular society in Canada. And my parents were children of that revolution. In a sense, I was a grandchild of that revolution. No, I grew up with religion being pushed aside and replaced by art. When I was growing up, if we wanted to understand something about the human condition, who we are, why we are, it was done through art, through reading great novels, seeing great plays, seeing great paintings, listening to great music. And that's a very good way of doing it. I had no problems with that. I grew up bathed in art and eventually became an artist myself, a writer. However, in my early 30s, as I was backpacking in India, I came to see the limits of who I'd become. As a result, perhaps of my innate personality and of having studied philosophy at university, I realized that I was too beholden to reason. Now, there's nothing wrong with rationality in itself. It is an extraordinarily powerful tool. For example, here I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm talking to you in Texas through the miracle of technology. I have a cell phone, I have a phone, I've been vaccinated, I've flown on planes, I've driven cars, I've used computers every day. Our lives have been immeasurably improved through rationality. However, all this rationality still at the end of the day is just a tool, a very powerful tool, but it's a tool. And a tool only makes sense if you have a reason, if you find a reason to use it. You know, the most obvious example, it only makes sense to pick up a screwdriver if you have a screw that needs turning. And I came to realize while I was traveling in India, and India is central to this because India is a society that is bathed in things that are not necessarily rational, whether religion, folklore, whatever. It's a place that bathes in a kind of luminous insanity, for better and for worse. And it was a startling contrast to my own slightly dry way of thinking. So I came to see that I was becoming too reasonable, and it was leading me nowhere. Reason, in a sense, on its own, doesn't give us a reason to do anything. Reason just doesn't justify itself. It's just a means to an end, but you have to figure out what that end is before you can properly use reason. Anyway, all this to say, I got to India, and I saw all this extraordinary craziness. Sometimes it's terrible craziness. It's a very corrupt place and all that, with heinous things like the caste system. But religion is still very on site in India. You see it everywhere. Of course, there's hundreds of millions of Hindus, millions and millions of Muslims, of Christians, of every religion is there and in a very spectacular way. And for the first time, I saw more benign manifestations of religion. I was used to seeing the stuff in religion that I hate, the homophobia, the sexism, the patriarchy, the twisting of religion to justify someone's evil purpose. For the first time in India, I saw people who weren't out to put down women or Jews or whatever, who through religion were seeing a much wider universe than I was. And I came to see how art and religion, I can see why they've been paired together for so many centuries, why so often religion has used art to express itself. For example, going back to Jesus, he incessantly talked using parables. A parable is a literary device. It's a very compressed, symbolic way of passing on information. It's a literary device. The Gospels themselves can be seen as allegories, as I was mentioning earlier on. These miracles of Jesus are much richer if they are seen as having allegorical content. I came to see how the two match each other, art and religion, because both are grand forms of storytelling. And what's extraordinary about religion is it goes even further. It posits that stories aren't just stories, but in fact are the underlying reality of the universe. And so I came to see that as not being in opposition to my reading, to my reason, sorry, to my rationality, but as being a complement to it, that you can be reasonable and can believe in an overall plan to this universe. They can wed together, that there is no contradiction between science and religion, for example. Or there is only if you seek there to be conflict, if you're some Taliban fundamentalist or something like that. So it completely radically changed my perspective on religion while I was in India. Coming from a background that was entirely secular, I've come round to very broadly having a kind of faith. And I'm not particularly denominational. I'm broadly comfortable with Christianity because I'm a Westerner, and the West has by and large been defined by Christianity. But I also, Islam, which sadly has been bullied and abused by any number of ways, so it has a very bad reputation. It's actually a beautiful religion. It is not about hate. It is about collegiality, fraternity, sorority of humankind. In many ways, it's a very beautiful religion. So is Hinduism. So I've come to love all of these ways. And the way I put it in Life of Pi is that to me these are all wells. And each well is different and is in a different location on the earth. But they all reach the same divine groundwater. They're each attempts to understanding that ultimately is something beyond our understanding. So they're all human attempts to understand something beyond our understanding. And they now all sit very well with me. I'm quite happy in any kind of religious godhouse, as I call it in Life of Pi. I'm happy in churches, mosques, temples. I see it as a wonderful way to see a greater vision of life.
So apart from certainly influencing the content, the subject matter of your novels, do you feel like the recognition of some kind of maybe universal human hunger for something beyond rationality, did that expand your capacity as an artist immediately? What did it take some time for you to recognize that maybe that was the missing piece?
I saw it quite soon as I started writing Life of Pi, because you, as a writer, you cannot write about something unless you get on the inside of it. Mm-hmm. So when I posited Life of Pi, I said to myself, well, because every book I've written has been an attempt to understand something. So when I started writing Life of Pi, it was an attempt to understand religion. How can, after all these centuries of the triumph of science and technology and rationality, how can there still be people who believe in gods? So to understand that, I had to get on the inside. So I posited a character who believed, who practiced three religions. Why three? Because I didn't want him to be a monomaniac. I didn't want him to be seen as an evangelical character, because that would be off-putting to people who weren't of that faith. So I thought, if I haven't practiced three religions, I'll relativize organized religion, and I'll get to what is really interesting, which is faith, because that's the key to any religion, is faith, that belief in something for which there's no reproducible, verifiable evidence, that letting go of rationality and making that leap towards the loving unknown. That's what's really fascinating about religion. So if I'm going to discuss that, I have to posit a character who does that. And if I'm going to posit a character who does that, I have to myself invest myself in it. So I started reading all the great texts of the great religions, reading secondary texts about them to explain that to me. And right away, that was transformative. Now, did it change me as a writer? No, it certainly changed me as a human being. Now I find it much easier to let go. And that's, by the way, I think is the big difference between faith and belief. Some people, and the United States is a perfect example of this, you have many, many, let's talk about Christians because it's the United States, many Christians who I'd say would have belief, they cling and they exclude. To me, it's a fearful reaction. To me, the true religious reaction is, the true expression of religiosity is to have faith. And when you have faith, you let go, you trust, and you do not judge. You let God do his, her work, and you just trust that it'll all work out. So Pi is a character who lets go. And in studying that, in doing all this religion research on religion, it was immediately transformative, because I was suddenly realizing that, oh, I can let go, because that's the difference with reason. Reason doesn't manage to let go. The scientist, the rationalist, always wants to understand, and they will never let go. And that can work with certain very concrete problems. But let's think of the problem of evil, the problem of death. If you're a completely secular person, an utter materialist, who believes, and this is a perfectly believable thing, millions of people believe in this in our secular world, that basically we're the result of cosmic chance, some sort of chemical soup out of which popped up an amoeba, and eventually from amoebas descended us and every other creature. That is the scientific truth of things. If you limit yourself to that, that may be all well and good rationally, but what do you do when, let's say, your daughter is killed or your spouse is murdered? What do you do with suffering and death? Well, nothing. Rationality, the material world, has no explanation for it. It can certainly describe it. You can write a great novel about it, perhaps, but it doesn't actually explain it. The extraordinary thing about religion is that it does put it in a greater context. It does paint a greater picture in which evil and suffering plays a role. And if only we could see that greater picture, we would understand it. And it therefore helps you to let go. And that was the immediate effect it had on me, a greater capacity to let go, to accept the ephemerality of life, its fleetingness, the fact that I am in a primitive car racing towards death and trying to feel at home in a thing that is essentially, I'm essentially homeless. It allowed me to let go. So as a human being, it transformed me. As a writer, well, it directed some of my books. I mean, Life of Pi looked at faith and religion. The High Mountains of Portugal also. The book in between, Beatrice and Virgil, which is an allegory on the Holocaust, less so. So as a writer, it didn't play as much of a role. But certainly as a human being, it changed me.
In the final part of the book, I was really fascinated by the relationship between Peter, this Canadian senator who travels to Oklahoma and ends up at the spur of the moment adopting a chimpanzee from a preserve, a medical research facility. I was fascinated by this never quite extinguished fear that Peter, the senator, feels for Odo. He loves him, but he knows he could be badly hurt. And I thought about this and thought about this. That's always how love works, isn't it? Whoever it is we love, we have to accept that that closeness means the other person could destroy us, if not physically,
absolutely,
then emotionally.
Yeah. Once again, when we fall in love, we open ourselves. And when you open yourself, you open yourself up to the good stuff, but also to the bad stuff. And that relationship between Peter and Odo, the chimpanzee, you know, that relationship of love with an element of fear, well, just look at the Old Testament. Hmm. There's full of that wrathful God who is nonetheless loving. You know, that's the way. And even Jesus, you know, he did get angry at the money changers in the temple. You know, there's so many readings we can have of Jesus. You can sort of turn him into this sort of namby-pamby loving figure. Well, no, there was more gut to the man, more backbone to the man than that. You know, his disciples were constantly confronted by him, were constantly thrown off kilter by things that he said. After all, if you read the Gospels, you know, he's constantly telling them things that they do not understand. He constantly has to explain to them the parables. So they're obviously constantly uncertain about themselves with him, and yet they're completely bound to him. It's, you know, as you said, it's a perfect example of true love.
And the other fascinating thing about Odo is his relationship to time. He's entirely unlike a human, or maybe he's like the most, you know, elevated human ever, in that he exists entirely in the present.
Well, that's one of the things why I use animals so often in my fiction, because I find they're wonderful foils to us as human beings. Animals, for example, largely live in the present moment. Of course, they have memory, so they can't access the past, but it's a very sort of functional memory, used only when need be. And they have no capacity to contemplate the future, and why would they? They can do nothing about their future. They can do about their immediate present. You know, if you're a gnu, a wildebeest on the plains of Africa, and a lion is charging towards you, well, you can tell that your future in the next 5 seconds, if you don't start running, is going to be you're going to die. So they have a very limited capacity. So they basically live in the present moment like Buddhist monks. Buddhists spend their entire life trying to live in the present moment, where your average cat and dog and every other animal lives in the present moment the whole time. And it's interesting, religious figures do the same thing. Just to take the example of Jesus, you get a sense of Jesus of being very much in the present moment, having an incredible sense of presence, of being right here, right now. It's a curious animal-like quality. And then if you see animals as living in the present moment, it's a curious Jesus-like quality. So to me, they're at either extreme of us, and we're the ones in the middle who find it so difficult to be in the present moment. We're always bedeviled by our past and worried about the future, and we sort of forget about the present moment, even though it's the only moment that is the present moment. So we are stuck between the divine and the animal. And we have to try to reconcile those two extremes, because obviously we don't want to be animals. We want to aspire to the divine, but we are fundamentally animals. We are, Darwinism is not wrong. We are associated. We are related to all these animals. So how do we reconcile our divine and our animal natures? Well, that's the quest of a lifetime. But indeed, the senator lives with Odo, trying to achieve that right balance.
The new novel by author Yann Martel is called The High Mountains of Portugal. His other books include Self, Beatrice and Virgil, and Life of Pi. Yann, it's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It's always wonderful to talk to NPR. You are the voice of sanity.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer, and I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.